And welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're coming live from, well, will be recorded by the time this kind of goes on, but from the ICM in one of the dining halls, so you'll have a bit of background information and background sound that we don't normally have. But as per usual, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm Mary Steen. I'm a professor of midwifery. I'm now at Northumbria University in the UK, but I was previously in Adelaide as the professor of midwifery at UniSA, and before that at Chester. So yeah, that's me.
You've covered a few grounds.
I've covered a few miles. I've covered a few places, haven't I?
So let's go right back to the beginning then. So how did you get into midwifery?
Well, obviously, I've gone through the old, because I've just turned 60, so obviously I did my general nurse training first, so I was a registered general nurse. I was always interested in midwifery, but to be honest, I would have considered sick children's nursing. It was going to be one or the other, but the pathway seemed to take me when you apply for midwifery, so I followed the pathway. And I applied to a few because I'm obviously from West Yorkshire.
Yep.
So you, obviously out there you're, you know, quite young still. You're just in your early 20s after you've done your nursing. And I did a little bit of nursing. I was always interested in wound care and pain relief and trauma, which I've actually brought into midwifery and a lot of my research. So there was some transferable sort of ideas and some skills there. And I'd applied to St. James's. There was the Leeds Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust, or there was Wakefield, Manygates, or Sheffield. You know, I was what was doable at that time, because you didn't go far, you know, from home then. And Wakefield came up early, and you'd laugh, it was September the 8th, the start date. Well, that's Our Lady's birthday.
Oh.
Well, I come from a very kind of Irish Catholic family, so I thought that's a good omen.
Oh, yeah.
So I do that. So I actually chose Wakefield, and I knew that I would get home birth experiences, whereas in Leeds, it was still quite medicalised, because we're talking, you know, the mid-80s. When I did my midwifery, and I thought, no, I want to go to Wakefield where I'll be able to really support women with a social model of care and to do really experience home births and learn how suturing was. So it was a choice to follow that pathway.
So how long did you stay within that area and doing that after you finished your education training?
Yeah, I did the 18 months education and training, and then I actually got a job back in Leeds.
Okay.
So, and that was fascinating. And I worked at both sides of Leeds, Teaching Hospitals and NHS Trust, and then I went to St. James's in Leeds. And it was quite an eye-opener because they were very medicalised. I mean, in Wakefield, they didn't even have piped, you know, Entonox.
Oh.
It was just cylinders. And lots of home births, and it was good to a point, but then if a woman really needed something, they only had a 2% epidural rate.
Wow.
They had to go up to Pinderfields, which was the general hospital. So there was advantages and disadvantages from it, whereas when I went to the LGI, oh my God, I was eye-opener. It was quite, this is the room for the obstetricians, this is the room for the midwives. I went, oh, okay.
And then, separated completely.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd said to her at the time, could I wear my brown shoes, because I didn't have a lot of money. I'd just a student nurse, a student midwife, and I had a baby in arms myself. And they said, oh yeah. And then when I got there, I got told off, no, you need the black shoes. You know, it was quite, I thought, oh, this is interesting. All women were flat on their backs. There was still, like, as if it were in theater in the rooms, with like the stainless steel there, and flat, and they had a little wedging, and I was horrified because midwives would break their waters and they would say, you can confirm, Mary, and then they would have a baby's, some of the hair from the baby's head, you know.
And so you'd actually have to take it
in the cocker,
Oh, wow.
And I was like, no, that's not what I've been taught.
No.
You know, we had like a little amniotone. If we did have to break women's waters, it was a little, it was like a false nail that went on your finger.
Yep.
And you would thread in, and it was really, and it just popped. It was so gentle. Whereas here, there were, you know, it was just so but it was good experience because I could see how
not to do it
and medical and medicalized. And then they were interested in that they were doing the sort of digital and the labor ward kind of system, which was obviously different to when you go everywhere. And I remember saying, oh, yeah, is that for, you know, Elizabeth, the, you know, our queen? They went, no, Ellen Road. I went, oh, which is the football. I thought, oh, fair enough.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that was quite interesting. And then obviously you rotate to antenatal, postnatal wards, the clinics. And I actually quite liked more that because it was, there was a cult and a culture on that labour ward. And you were careful how to manage the microcultures, really, and the environment. But it was quite good that I'd done that. And then it got to the stage where I was struggling with my little one and, like, childminding her out, that I wanted more set hours.
Yep.
And interestingly enough, I'd read a lot of work about Jimmy Walker's work, mm-hmm. a professor, and he was doing a lot of work with the antenatal daycare. And Peter Buckman was the obstetrician at St. James's, so I thought, I'm going to apply there. A job came up, they were opening an antenatal day unit, and I thought, I like that. And I'd read a load of work on Jean Proud's work, and I was into, like, the scans and, you know, for centre previa, and I thought, oh, I'll apply just on the off chance. It's a job share, and then I can maybe make my hours up casual,
yep.
you know, on the bank, and that would fit in with, obviously, having a little boy.
Much nicer balance.
Balance, so I decided, anyway, I got it, and then, funny enough, the head of midwifery, at the LGI said, well, we can give you nights now, because you know, I were going to go do all nights. I went, no, I've actually got this job and I'm quite interested in it, and we can do, and it was a way to do research, and that got me into research as well, because they were exploring the benefits of the antenatal day unit instead of admitting women to the antenatal ward, that we could actually give them the care in an antenatal day unit, and how, and they were looking at different ways to book a woman. Richard Lilford, he was another really good researcher, and Simon Turrell, and I used to do scans with him. And it was a nice, and it were nice hours, if you like, when you've got a little one. But I'd do the odd shift on labour ward,
yep.
or, you know, or there. And even at helping out my own GPs, he said, I need a practice nurse. And I thought, well, I could do a few hours mm-hmm. for you, because you could, you know, you were dual trained. And that got me to do all the smears and things, which
good.
You didn't do as a midwife.
No.
Which, when you look at the US and everything, they do.
Well, it's in with the scope of practice.
Yes, yeah, it's in the scope of practice.
Yeah.
So I actually got, via that route, that I could be, you know, build all those scopes up to do all the smears and vaccinations and things. So that fit in. So that for a while. And then obviously you have more, you know, a few more children. So you've got to, so then it did become nights and days and labour ward and, you know, all around. So it's always that balance, isn't it, between with young, really young
yes.
children and being a midwife. And it was, and I always wanted to be a community midwife, and I was fascinated in research. And my first baby was a keel and forceps. And I remember it was like, I couldn't sit down, and nobody really kept, oh, for goodness sake, you know, you've only had a baby, Mary. I could not sit down, but you must breastfeed. I thought, yeah, but I'm in agony here. And it were black silk sutures then, because I remember that they had to come out. And I thought, oh, it's so good. And then I remember one, and because I've got, as you know, I've got a sense of humour, Liz. And they said, well, you can sit on a frozen pack of peas, Mary. And I went, oh, the bird's eye. I said, I'd only sit on bird's eye. Even though I'm in agony, you know. And I didn't even look down there, you know, with it after we got stitches. And then I remember, and he was born on the 25th of January, my birthday's the 30th of January, so my sutures had to come out on the fifth day. And I thought, oh my God, what? How horrible is this, you know?
This is my birthday. Hoping I've taken out.
Yeah. And then I thought, surely there's something. And then I got, and then my husband was a keen footballer, and he was a scouser. And he'd injured his knee, and he had this cold compress on, and I thought, my God, he's got there for his knee after football, and I can't sit down with these stitches. And then, and that's the kind of idea. I wonder if I can specifically design something for mm-hmm. women. You know, why haven't we got summer? And when I said, you know, they've told me to sit on a frozen pack of peas, we give them the saltwater sachet,
yep.
frozen.
Those are rock hard.
Rock hard? Is it doing more harm than good? Because you do it for a couple of days, but then you thought, my God, the corners stick in you.
Yep.
It's rock hard, it's wet. So you think, why bother, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So I thought, why haven't we got something specific design for women? So I started exploring, and I went to And I asked one of the obstetricians, and Jimmy Walker did help me actually, because he could see that. He said, you've got real potential to, you're quite, and I could do statistics as well. I was quite bright that way. And he said, I've got this idea. And Martin Griffiths Jones, the other obstetrician that I worked closely with, and he said, well, go explore. So I went to Johnson & Johnson 3M, and they were like, is there a need? Is this women are like there? And then one project manager, I kid you not, he said to me, because they were always, it's always monitoring how much money make and what's it, he said, well, actually, maybe we could, because we make a large size for horses.
Horses get better treatment than what women do.
A larger size for horses. I says, well, that's very nice for our horses after the, you've been horse racing and they've got injuries, but I need something specifically designed for women. So you've got sports injuries, and it's mostly was the men, wasn't it?
Yep.
In the rugby and football. And you've got large for horses, but nothing for women.
No.
I thought, well, marvellous. Anyway, one of the guys, because in Leeds and everything, it's like the Irish community, and he'd seen me trying and getting knocked back, and he went, I'll have a go at making them for you. And he was really, because he's quite innovative, and it created jobs, and he made the machines that could make what we call the fem pad, the cooling gel pad. And I did an initial trial in 1992-93.
Wow.
And I got told that midwives don't do randomized control trials. And I said, well, we do now.
Oh.
And that was at St. James's in Leeds. And I went and got some funding, which they were really, and my head of midwifery went to London with me. She was so proud. So we were starting to do
Yay.
It. And the midwives were obviously very challenging because they did, with research, but I kind of did a small study. 27, 28 and 29 was in the first study.
Yep.
And I had to do ice pack, the new treatment, my fem pad, and Epiform, because Epiform was being used at the time, the anti-inflammatory, which we'd imported from, because that originally was designed for rectal pain.
Yep.
And hemorrhoids, but we did use it for like after episiotomies and pains. Don't know why, but I had to do that because it was the standard regimen.
Yes.
Well, really, it'd have been easy to just do two groups,
yep.
but no, three. But it's good because I learned all the different sort of statistics and things. And with that evidence, and I had to obviously work, so I never give up, and time was passing by. I went for an NHS Executive Research Fellowship, and it was Jimmy Walker that supported me, the obstetrician. And he said, no, I think you could do it, Mary. You've got the evidence. You've done like a feasibility study.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You've done a small study, a pilot. Let's do you could do a larger randomized control trial. Now, and I went, you really think I could? And he said, you could do your PhD, you're clever, you've got your BSc honours, you've got first, you could do it. I said, really? And so he really supported me. So, that is excellent, isn't it? Work. Anyway, I went and I had to be interviewed and everything, and I didn't think I'd get it. and I was the first midwife to get an NHS Executive Research Fellowship, which now is the NIHR.
Yep.
So I was
which is critical for midwives funding for PhDs in the UK.
And they would have given me it full time, but I didn't want to. I said I still wanted to do some research.
Yeah.
Because it passed and I'd been given a community midwifery post. So I said, well, if I job share and Verena Wallace had come and she could do like the consultant midwifery bit, I could do research, but we could share a caseload. Because I wasn't ready to give up, and it wasn't till I think it might have been Mary Renfrew who said you can't be at the moment the way the system is a research practitioner, but that's what I wanted to be.
Yes.
And she said you can, and you do a lot of education as well, Mary. You can do two out of the three, but trying to do all three, you're going to have to make a decision. But you could do the ripple effect because you're good at and teaching, and you've got them. And then in that 5 years, and then when I did the big study, got all working. She said, really, how you've managed to, persuade, if you like. She said, you've got really good persuasive skills. I said, well, effective communication skills. We've all been really quite, they've been there years and didn't do research to actually change that culture, to have a positive culture, research culture, and to do a randomised control trial.
It's really interesting.
And then the obstetricians were quite shocked that this young midwife, staff midwife with these three children, were doing this research and a randomised control trial, and then she got the funding part-time. And I never practically lived on Labour Ward, because you have to do. And then they were saying, oh, you're going to pick an envelope, Mary, A or B. And I said, oh, no. I said, I'm going to do a computer-generated list of numbers in block size of six. And they were like...
Formal, proper, like real.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Where's she come from? And I said, how does she know that? I didn't. But I knew a really nice man that could help me, the IT manager who set up Lebdil.
That's what it
is. I said to him, Mike Kelly, I love him to bits. And I went, Michael, could you help me, please? He said, what would you like, Mary? And so I was explaining, I want it randomised, and I've got this trial. He goes, yeah, okay, I could do that Lebdil, that I can set that up for you. And all it cost me, a nice cup of tea.
Oh. See, that's the best thing about barter system and people that you know, that you go to the skills, they're willing to help because it's what they do and they enjoy doing it.
Yeah. And he went, yeah, and he tried to help me, and then I got the guys that would collect all the data, the IT, and do their, and because I was trying to learn all about statistics and how to do it, and it was SPSS 6 then,
oh, gosh.
Version 6,
yeah.
So we're like, what, on 26?
26
now,
or
we?
Something like that.
But because I'd have a go myself and try, yep. they were willing to help me,
yeah.
Because I was interested. You know, but obviously I'm not the expert in that area, they are. So they really kind of helped me. Then you change the culture. And I remember the first, when it first started and I had my questionnaires there to be, you know, when it come up on Lebdil, you know, if it would be ice pack or Epiphone. And I got all bathing. And the second big trial, we didn't have to do Epiphone, but they didn't want the no treatment group. So it was just called bathing. So it called bathing. Well, everybody, hot and cold therapy, bathing. So that was fine to get around that with ethics. And I remember being on days the next day on the postnatal ward doing a shift on ward 3. And I thought, oh, has anybody recruited? You know, I was really nervous. And then there was five that had come through onto the postnatal ward that had been randomised into the study. So I was really, so that started me off, you know, with the research and on community. And it was so nice. And the women were saying, but the midwives were terrors. They were like, honestly, they were like, at the cooling gel pads, and I had so many, and I had three in a box because I wanted them so they could take them home with them and reuse them.
Yep.
Because pain don't stop at the hospital.
No, exactly not.
At 48 hours, I demonstrated that for the first 7 days they used them, and pain was worse on a night.
Yep.
So I got all that evidence from the first study. And then I go on and I says, look, these fem pads at the labour ward desk. There was Sister Lois with it on her head. I've got a migraine. So she was using me cooling gel pads for migraine.
So when they admitted that they worked, but not for what you wanted them to work for.
It was so versatile. And then there were around the wrist. Somebody had burnt the hand on the kettle. I just thought, oh, my God. And then the other one was squeezing it like a squeeze ball because it's like a gel, blue gel, because she was doing all the work while they were doing that. And I said, look, I've only got so many. You know, and the women have to go on with them and reuse them. And then when it took the trial, because they were learning about intention to treat, and they were saying, but all the women need them. I said, you can't do that. It's a randomised controlled trial. They're randomised to either the ice pack or bathing.
So education of the staff is critical.
And then I say, and then a couple of the young ones didn't understand. I said, well, you can't randomise them. They've got to have informed choice. They've got to understand, haven't they, what, you know, what it is that it may be that they don't get. The fem pad. You know, so you had to explain that to them. And then this little Asian woman was saying, oh, yeah, I've got the Mary pad. Because they're associating me with the pad. Like, oh, my gosh, okay.
You could have named it the Mary pad. Why not? They've got Kylie sheets.
Yeah, that's true. So that was quite good. And then just analysing the data and with that fellowship and doing the PhD, and it was kind of, and Jimmy Walker just took me under his wing.
So that's what I was going to say, how did it with your supervisors, because it was something that developed, did they just jump on board to help supervise you?
Yeah, there was a bit of trouble. There was one supervisor at the university that was trying to claim it as his work.
Unfortunately.
So that year, but Jimmy Walker and Martin Griffiths-Jones, the two obstetricians from the trust, were behind me. Because he was thinking, because I got it patented and they supported me. But this other supervisor was trying to go down a different path and get it patented. And that, so there was a bit of trouble. But the actual trust, I was their midwife, they supported me.
Good.
Against the university. They're saying, you can't do this, it's the midwife's work.
Yeah.
So I was, even though there was, you know, somebody that tried to take credit
for it. Obviously saw the benefit of it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there would have been, and it wasn't about that, because I said, I've never made any money from it. The money that ever came from the FemPad went into another project about meeting the needs of abused women. Because you wouldn't get funding for that.
No.
And I would work, and then I'd started working for a charity called Stop, Start Treating Others Positively, and I could use it like for there. And it was, I had a really good head of midwifery. Well, Miss Cooper, she looked after me first. That was when I got my first award. And then it was Anne Geddes.
Yep.
And they would find, and then because they knew I wanted to do research, but there was no pathway or no role, specific role for a midwife. She would find me little pockets of money to do little projects.
Oh, nice.
And that, and still I could do the clinical and, yep, then doing, and then doing the PhD. So it kind of all went, and with the children, and that's how I developed sort of to become a midwifery researcher.
So what actually got you into research in the first place? Were you interested as a student? Like, no. Or what was it? So what kind of got your attention about research?
When I just saw women, I was on the postnatal ward when they were really bad with perineal trauma and couldn't sit down, and they were being ignored. And it was like, we'll just give you the ice pack, and it was kind of downplayed. And I thought, 85% of women have stitches or some sort of trauma. This is quite big. You know, we've put all this effort into breastfeeding. If she can't sit down comfortably, how do you expect, yep, her to breastfeed?
Yep.
Let's step back here a minute. And why haven't we got something specifically designed for women? And I had a flashback, and I remembered, like, I was that woman only a few years ago, and this woman's crying here in pain, and we're not addressing it. You know, we should have never, you know, allowed that to happen. We should, yep, be in there saying, how can we help you? How can we alleviate your pain?
Yeah.
So that's what got me into research, that I thought, we can do something better here. But for me to do it, I'm going to have to demonstrate evidence, aren't, yeah, I? And I'd obviously, we'd gone back, because remember, we were registered general nurses, registered midwives. So they were doing the CATS scheme, that you could then get credit to get your level 2, mm-hmm, and level 3, because they didn't know how to put you forward with credits
when
as a nurse
both,
or a midwife, yeah, to go get your BSc honours degree. And then I liked the research, and obviously the research modules, and that got me into, yeah, I want to do research.
Yeah. So when you think back to your PhD now, and with the data collection, what's something that sticks in your memory that surprised you about the process of doing your PhD?
I think the length of time that it takes, because it's not...
Especially part-time.
Yeah, part-time. It's not overnight. And how you fit it in with all your other sort of commitments.
And how did you fit it in? So apart from kind of bits and pieces here, did you have set study times when the kids were in school or kids were at sleep? How did you,
yeah,
kind of juggle all that?
I did it, obviously, at weekends, evenings, or a day off. And it took you a good half a day to get back into,
yeah,
where you'd left off, hadn't it, really? And how to pull it together. So you have to have sort of that perseverance. And it's interesting, because when we developed the FEMPAD, and I did focus group with women and asked them about different sort of plastic coverings, mm-hmm, and they wanted a nice soft one, and I thought they'd want it covered up, not clear, you know, so I assumed wrongly, because there was a lovely, like a blue,
yep,
lovely like plastic covering. No, and there were quite a diverse group, because I was obviously in Leeds, and we've got a,
yeah,
very,
very
diverse,
diverse
background, and in Beeston area, so it was all there. So I had Black Afro-Caribbean ones in my focus,
nice,
group, Asian women, you know, so it was well attended. And and they went, honey, we want to see what we're getting. I went, oh, okay.
Well, this is the most intimate place you can be, really,
yeah,
isn't
so we had the clear. So that was quite nice to do, the trial. And even looking at the data, and when it's your own data, you look at data when you're doing your degree and it's like boring, isn't it? But when it's yours,
yeah,
you're fascinated. And interestingly enough, when we developed it, and I got, they had Martin Griffiths Jones and Jimmy Walker helped me. They had labs and things, because it's a big centre at St James's in Leeds to do research, and gone over to the lab. And in our first study, we made our own gel pads, and then,
yep,
I got my friend to make them, you know, and he set up a company, Florifem, and it created jobs for women.
Fabulous.
From 9 till 3, so it's a social enterprise, actually, in a poor area of Leeds. So that was an added bonus that obviously I didn't expect. So the women were making it for the women. So it was really, really nice.
That's nice little,
yeah,
give back.
Yeah, and then this was by chance, so I didn't think about it. Well, of course, if women have got perineal trauma, a high proportion of them will have hemorrhoids, you know, as well. And I really didn't consider that. I should have done, because Epiphone were for rectal pain. Mm. Anyway, when we made the gel pads, for some reason, they were an inch longer than I'd, because I'd measured the perineum.
And, yep,
like, you know, everything had to be just so, and like a sanitary towel, and, you,
yep,
know, the shape, and I'd ask women, and they were an inch longer. So I was like, but they're an inch longer, like that. Anyway, as it happened, 25% of the women had hemorrhoids, and they wrote about how it was so helpful for hemorrhoids. So the obstetricians, everybody were having a joke, as we do, don't we, humour in obstetrics and all that. Mary, that inch did matter.
The size does count.
I know, just like, so that was like, I did, that was by chance.
Yeah.
as I was doing but the research.
You look at so many things that happen serendipitously, that happen because somebody opened a door somewhere, and none of it's planned.
Yeah.
And or it's a byproduct of something else, and you sit there and kind of go, well, that didn't work. Penicillin being the great thing, that was purely an accidentally left something open when he kind of went away and came back and kind of went, oh my God, that's killed that. But oh, so it's you don't know what's meant to be and what's not.
And I did publish as I went along, because Jimmy Walker said, so he really pushed us. So when I put my thesis in, I had all the and conference presentations, all the different stages from the development work, the focus group works, the pilot, all the reviews, everything to do with perineal trauma. And they used to call me Mary Perineum Steve. And it is Mary Patricia, actually. It is Mary P. I was like, oh, I'll take it as a compliment. And then that led me on, and then Anne Geddes had said, because she knows that I would like treat, she says, I've got a job for you. We've got a big project with LIAP, Leeds Interagency Project for Women and Violence. And I know you're really in that area because you're a community midwife, social model care. I want you to put a program together to educate all the midwives in Leeds.
Wow.
And she backed me, and that's what I did.
So how long were you in that job for?
She just like seconded me.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, because I could still do my 0.5 for my caseload. Because I loved, you know, I think 16 years as a community midwife. So I was happy, like, doing projects, but still having, you know, job sharing a caseload. And, I ended up educating 360 midwives in Leeds.
Oh,
and that's when we merged, because it was St. James's and the LGI. Yeah. And then we became Leeds Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust. So it was actually a good way to merge the midwives.
Absolutely.
Because when I started the workshops, when I put it together and piloted them, obviously the LGI midwives would sit at one side and the St. James's midwives would sit at the other side. And I'd actually worked at both. So, you know, I knew both. So,
that's the dream.
So then I ended up having to name them and mix and match them, and then they integrated. So that was quite nice. And it was really quite an eye-opener, because, you know, meeting the needs of abused women, because we were trying to problem solve when it's not our problem to solve. We're there to guide. Mm-hmm. So they did need the education and training.
Very much so, because we always want to go in and solve problems, but it's here are the resources. When you're ready, here's the steps you can take. This is the people you can contact to. And I think it takes, what, 7 times for a woman to leave in a breastfeeding relationship?
Yes.
Because of assortment of different reasons, whether kids, pets, kind of life, finances, loss of contact with outside family members, all of those kind of like abusive.
Oh, it was really fascinating, and we did ring it up, and it was English National Board then, before the UKCC, and so we had to write that up, that we'd done the work, and then other areas came in, and we even helped to educate and train in the armed forces, and there were some in Germany, SAFA, some of the midwives there, so it really did take off to help, sort of help women. But then it was, then we were discovering that a lot of midwives, themselves. So we had to obviously set up a support group, and I remember one community midwife, and she'd worked with me for years, and she was just about to retire, and she used to say when we were at home births, oh, you get yourself off, Mary, you know, you need to go home to your young ones. And I did click that she didn't want to go home.
Yep.
She was always at work.
Yep.
And then she moved, got a little flat, and she had quite an estranged, got a relationship with her 2 daughters, because obviously they've got a different perspective, and they blamed her, really, that she never left her abusive partner.
So hard.
And when she couldn't even light the gas stove, you know, with the pilot light, and so obviously the girls would help him because they're still her daughters, but she just said, and she had one profound statement, she went, I'm lonely, but I'm safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's just so interesting, isn't it?
But when you look at midwifery, and it is dominantly female, it is what's represented in community that we care for the women is going to be represented within the workforce itself, because we are the community.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, some people don't have that hassle, that don't have the ability to separate those two, or do a very good job of hiding.
Yeah. And that is interesting, because I will mention Anne Geddes, who really supported me. And obviously she was involved in training Mary Renfrew. She's a really good head of midwifery from Dundee. And she worked with Jimmy Walker and Jimmy Dreyfe, 2 very powerful obstetricians. One were from Glasgow, one from Edinburgh. It was really interesting. And she got me to do that project and educate all the midwives in Leeds, and we all there. And then years later, I'd gone and then I'd become a reader. Because she supported when I got my PhD, then that opens the doors, doesn't it?
So for those that aren't in the UK, a reader's actually a lecturer, an educator.
Associate professor.
Associate professor. You read at Oxford and Cambridge and universities, whereas you teach at other places.
So it's you're a reader, so you're an associate professor. You're at that level at University of Chester. And I was doing some work and I'd gone over to the States to do something and come back. And then I got some news from Verena Wallace, my friend. And she said, have you heard about Anne Geddes? So I thought, because she just retired. Yeah. Is she ill? You know, like that. She went, no, she says her husband has killed her.
So hence her interest came from somewhere that...
And we didn't know. And I just thought, wow, she got me as the, as she says, I was her little champion, to educate all the midwives to help women in Leeds, and she was in that powerful position and she was managing, yet what was going on behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Would you know? And she'd moved back up to Dundee and he charged with culpable homicide. And I couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
That was the outcome. And I was just hoping that it wasn't too traumatic for her, you know, so it really affected us all.
Yeah.
To say that she could help all those other women, but yet.
Ultimately.
Herself.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask you kind of like about celebrating your PhD, but I feel like that's kind of like a complete taking away from.
Oh, no, she was so proud of me. And when I went to the funeral, we all went up to Dundee, and he was never mentioned at the funeral. She had one daughter, Angela. She said, oh, you're the midwife. And I brought her back from Africa, her mother and baby, like there. She was so proud of you. And she said, you will get there, Mary.
Yep.
You know, and that's who she said to me, and I mentioned it in my workshop today. She says, remember one thing, Mary, you are as good as anyone, but better than no one.
Oh.
And with that, you will be a calm, caring, kind, you know, confident midwife. And I never forgotten that.
Beautiful sentiment.
And it was like, yeah, that's what you do. You know, really. So she is always, and when I do training and everything, she is always at the back of me. I can feel her. And I just thought, how sad that we, and I used to see her at aerobics and different things, and she did all the child protection. So that was her way of coping, and she'd watch me. And yet all that was going on. Afterwards, you reflect, don't you, and think, there was some signs, wasn't there?
Yeah, but unless people want help. You can't. You can only just show the resources.
Yeah, I mean, she was apparently leaving him, and she had a Scottish £50 note hidden, and he said he was depressed and tried to cover it up, and he ended up in care stays, which is like Rampton. So that was...
And
so,
quite often, unfortunately, that's a trigger when someone does leave.
Yeah.
That's the trigger, and we know that if there's any physical abuse, we know that strangulation... If they have got yet to the stage of strangulation, that they have got a much higher chance then of actually carrying through.
Yeah.
And you look at, I mean, even in here in Australia, we're still one woman a week, approximately, in the 21st century.
Yeah.
It's like, but I don't understand that. Anyway, let's go back to something nicer. How did you celebrate your PhD?
I think it was just a relief to get it. And then when you go, my children went with me.
Yep.
Because I was divorced by then. So I think sometimes it is hard to manage PhD work, home life, everything, children. So it does actually play a part in your relationships as well. So I've celebrated with, like, the kids, they were really proud, you know, that, you know, because it was women's experiences of perinatal trauma, and that you'd actually created it. And obviously this company that were making it for women in a socially deprived area of Leeds. So it was an added bonus. So we kind of just celebrated it like that. But my dad celebrated with me. He got me a private number plate for my car.
Oh!
It was really quite reasonable, but it was my name, M4RUY, Marui. So the four looked like an A.
Ah.
Oh, quite nice, wasn't it? Because I obviously come from a family where my dad was hardworking, you know, man, and my mum was a housewife, and then, as I called him, and, you know, he got called in those days, or did part-time jobs. So they kind of thought, well, where did we get her from?
Yeah.
You know, really. So, yeah.
So you've now gone into the education. You're now into Chester.
As a reader.
As a reader from there. So then how has the experience of doing a PhD and the knowledge that you got from that PhD, how has that then kind of like shaped the next kind of part of your career?
Well, because it was obviously the knowledge of research, because most of the people I work with are educators, aren't they? I would obviously take the dissertation module, mm-hmm. all the students, the undergraduates, look for funding, which I did and was quite successful to do.
Good on you.
to do research. And obviously I could do statistics and then I was quite quantitative then. So I was going to be, wasn't I, if I'd done trials and then you had to learn about different methodology. But just before I got the reader's post, there was a secondment for the Royal College of Midwives in New Planet with a joint appointment. So I thought, well, I'll do that to gain some experience. And then I could learn. And at UCLAN, I learned more about qualitative research, supported by Sue Down. And then she had a whole team. Dennis Walsh were there. It was really good. So I'd learned that. So that kind of was taking me on a path to become a mixed methods researcher.
Right.
Because I had the quantitative background, but then I had to develop the qualitative, which was in a good...
Which is definitely Sue's kind of like...
Yeah.
Paradigm.
And then when I got that experience and I was the first research fellow for the Royal College of Midwives.
That's cool.
So then that gave me a lot of open doors and going to Portugal. I just saw Victor Vigeur. Mm-hmm. He's here from Portugal. He's Vitor Virilia. And I did end up doing work at, you know, for the Royal College of Midwives.
The next, I think I saw a slide this morning. That in 2026, the next ICM is in Portugal.
Yeah, Lisbon, and he's just given me a key ring. So I've gone to Portugal, so I've done work for the Royal College of Midwives. I'm supported by Francis Day-Sterk, who used to was the former president of ICM here, and Carleen Davies, because I was on council and I had to step down because I'd become the research fellow. I didn't want any conflict of interest. So I ended up doing masterclasses for the Royal College of Midwives. Obviously, I'm doing work with UCLAN and got a lot of opportunities. And then as I developed that, like I was ready, like Sue Down says, you're ready to go and develop further. And that's when I took the reader's post at Chester. And funny enough, the dean had worked with me in Leeds. It's a small world, and he's from mental health background.
Oh, cool.
Mike Thomas. And we ended up writing Mental Health Across the Lifespan, and that got me, I always got into the mental health because of social model of care and what we see in community, and being a community midwife, ended up doing a lot more sort of education around mental health. And then a mix really with the different sort of research that you could actually do, and then developed maternity assist with Oracle because I was a supervisor. And then I went back and did after your PhD. I realised that teaching's a different set of skills. So I did my postgraduate diploma in health professional education. So you learn the teaching. So they're like saying, you've got quite a few strings to your bow, Mary. So you could, you can either do research in the workshops or you can do the clinical. So you've got a wide variation. And I was interested in, obviously, being a community midwife for years. I know the antenatal care pathways from NICE guidelines or anything. And Liverpool wanted to do their own, like Google. And it's big as Liverpool. So I worked with Duncan Fisher, and I'd done a lot of work with fathers. Mm-hmm. And with with Sue Down, she said, look at how we engage with fathers. Yep. And we've done a big, I got funding, and we're Leroy Adosin in Manchester. So it's kind of along that spread that you kind of go, don't you? From Leeds to Manchester to Liverpool to UCLAN, you know that it's there. And we've done a lot of work there, and a big pioneer for sort of involving fathers, Duncan Fisher, and he got his OBE for that work, come to me and said, what can we do and work? And
then nice, coming to you now. So they should.
And then developed maternity assist, and with Google, and we ended up getting quite a bit of funding, but from different trust funds. And I love Liverpool; they had a kitty, Lord, weren't they, in Liverpool? And then we got some funding from that, so we ended up getting about 125 sterling, which was quite a lot of money.
Yeah,
that was in like 2011, 2012 when I was doing that work, and. And we set it up, the whole pathway. And what you would do is they could register for maternity assist. They could nominate a partner. So if they didn't have a partner, it could be their mother. And it was quite, and a lot did in Liverpool. Or one young girl, she would come out of care. She nominated a friend. But that's fine because they were all getting information. So it's a really good way that you could do all the public health role of a midwife. So that was a really successful, and still using it, maternity assist.
Cool.
They did that. And then you get... people coming to you to help to supervise for PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I watched what other people were doing and obviously learning. And I had one particularly from Nigeria, Faith Diogru. And she said, and it was perineal trauma and over in Nigeria, and she would you supervise me. And she'd done a master's at Nottingham, and they'd actually recommended me at Jane Marshall, and I think
yep.
Dennis Walsh were at Nottingham at the time. And they said, the best person to supervise you is Mary Steen. If it's perineal trauma,
yep.
you're going to go to Mary Steen. And she emailed me, and I went, and I just put, yes, with a few S's, and she always remembers that. And she came, and she's successful, and did a PhD with me, and then went back and did work, and that's how I ended up in Nigeria, helping her, and that's gone from strength to strength, and she's the first nurse midwife to get a PhD in Nigeria.
Oh, definitely need to have her information so I can chat to her.
Definitely, and then I got the job. Obviously, I was going to go. Then Australia came up, so
just
it was
slight few miles
yeah,
extra.
But they all followed me. Yeah. And when she said, and she presented in Adelaide, and she says, "Where my prof goes, I go."
Yep.
You know, because they're obviously from the reader. I was only a reader, less than a year, and I applied for the professor, and I met the criteria.
Yep.
And they knew. You know,
well, you've got the funding as well. So
I got the publications,
the funding, and the supervision.
And then getting the supervision. So I had all, yeah. and patents.
Yeah.
So I had all P's.
Yeah.
And now we got worked, and they've got an African Excellence Centre, and the first time they put nurses and midwives, because they're both
yep.
in Austria, in Nigeria, because she's at Port Harcourt University, and I'd gone over and presented and really helped her, because they were against it, and she introduced birth balls and all things,
oh.
which were reasonable to the women, and like not to, you know, be doing the episiotomies unless absolutely necessary. And the World Bank, they involved myself, and I got Carol Gresh, who was the, well, she then was the head of school, but then became the provost at
yeah.
UniSA to back me. And we put in for a World Bank grant, and obviously Port Harcourt University, the PI, but we're the co-researchers,
yeah.
stroke educators, and we got it, 6 million. I was like, wow. And now we've got a professional doctorate for midwives at Port Harcourt University, and I run it with Faith Diogru,
yep.
and we have a master's, and the master's have to be midwifery and child health. It has to meet population needs.
Absolutely,
you know,
absolutely.
So absolutely. But the doctorate, but because COVID hit, she's got a load of midwives from all the different African countries that have actually enrolled because you can do Zoom.
Yeah.
And just before I came here, last week I was doing confirmations of candidature with all, and I've got a midwife from Uganda that I supervise, and we're doing there. So it's going to spread, because that's going to be all the leaders going into the different countries.
Traditionally we've had that there's been, in a lot of the countries that have not had the infrastructure to mm-hmm. be able to do postgraduate studies. Mm-hmm. So they've had to physically move to other countries to do the postgraduate studies.
Like Faith Diogru had to come and
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
She did a master's at Nottingham, and then she'd come and did a
Papua
PhD
New Guinea,
with me,
Kenya, Ghana, I like so many people. Do you see one of the advantages of COVID now being research without borders, that we can do yeah. a whole PhD yeah. supervision session online?
Mm-hmm. I just did on Tuesday, and I watched all the confirmations at candidature, all, you know, the students. Well, there were over 2 days. I just had, because
yep.
mine were on, so I said I could do one day,
yeah.
and I obviously had to watch my own PhD candidate, but you can't. Into, yeah. you know, I can take
sit there and get nervous, yeah.
And like, you know, she's doing quite well. And it's interesting because they're very clinical, because a lot of the doctors are there and obstetrician led, and they want obviously trials, clinical trials.
Yep.
And they're not understanding that you can do qualitative research yet on
yep.
mixed methods. So there was going to be a transition, you know, for that. But they've come from all different countries. So I was allocated a midwife from Uganda, mm-hmm. Eve. But the all, and that's nice that it's opened the borders.
Yeah.
But they've actually got the centre in Port Harcourt in Nigeria. But they're getting free, you know, and you love it when they come and they go, "Hello, my sister. Hello, my African sister. Hello, my." And they're going, and then she'll tell the story. And when we do, I do sessions online for the, you know, the taught part of the doctorate to show them how to do a type of.
Yep.
Different literature
yep.
review and the Prisma, you know, all the skills, maybe an integrative review with Remington and Toronto and
yep.
Remington, and they love it because they're learning.
Yeah.
And then she'll say, but they'll start and they're like, "Oh, my sisters, there's no, you know, that we are no different."
Yeah.
And so it is nice that it has opened, but COVID actually, she was focusing on obviously Nigeria, but it actually expanded to all the other African countries because of COVID. And they have enrolled and they're able to study for like this professional doctorate that's got the funding at this centre and from the World Bank, because it was all public health and toxicity, because they have a lot of issues over in Nigeria there. But they brought the nursing and midwifery in, and they've got, and then just before I came here, she just is the first full professor of midwifery in Nigeria. So how that ripple effect.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is going to be, we've talked about here at the ICM, we had at the opening plenary session, we had young leaders and a fantastic talk by a young leader, Anita, and about that we need their leaders of the future, and they're going to be the young ones, because all of us oldies are kind of like at the other end of our careers.
We've got a succession plan, haven't we?
And it is, but you see the energy coming from them and you sit there and go, and I get emotional about it. We do have a future. We have an amazing, powerful, energetic future. And we look at that with the way that midwifery research is growing. Like the ICM has been around 100 years. We look at this as the decade. And when I was talking to Franca, this is the decade of midwifery research. So if we use this decade of the 20s, we get to 2030 and really look back at the amazing amount of research we've done in midwifery, we are going to be a voice that has to be listened to. Because we do have that spread, and it's a global spread now of research being generated that is going to change individual countries, individual cities. But it is, we're going to get there because they can't argue against the evidence.
It's exciting. They try, though.
They cherry pick. Oh, they do try.
Confirmation bias, you know, you always have to say. And to be honest, we're human beings, and we will look for evidence that supports our views. I mean, so we have to accept that, but then we have to try and step back and say, no, hang on here. Let's, you know, look at all. Let's not cherry pick, basically. But I think it's exciting that there's that ripple effect. Mm. That is coming through in the different countries, because I've done a lot of work with midwives in Brazil.
Yep.
And I've had PhD students there, and obviously a child nurse as well, because it wasn't far off. So I ended up doing a lot of work with eating disorders and adolescents, because it's the same methodology. Mm. You know, maybe different target populations. And then that one of the midwives from Brazil has come to work with me in UK as an assistant professor, even though, you know, obviously, there's always issues around visas and getting through. But you get through those barriers and hurdles, don't you? And then now I see myself as the mentor, because I have a lot of PhD students that are really coming on. And there's a lot that are international. English is not their first language.
Yeah, and they're amazing, aren't they?
Well, Mitra, Giovanna Mad, Sweka Hoffman. I got that, you know, when I was in Australia. And Sweka followed me as well, because she got in touch with me at Chester, and then she came to Australia to do a PhD with me.
But that's it, the relationship that you have with a PhD professor or supervisor, especially if you're doing it part-time, it is a relationship. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can be more intense than a marriage.
Yeah.
Because your ups and downs, you're vulnerable, you need to be able to have trust in that person, because they're going to see
you as well.
And you go from this kind of like the supervisor has all the knowledge, and then you slowly kind of increase your knowledge to, ultimately you should be the kind of the one who is the most knowledgeable about that one area. Mm-hmm. But that is, it's a very intense relationship. So to have that good relationship, you will follow them anywhere, because you don't want to have to break someone else in new. You don't want to have to kind of start from scratch again. You don't know what you're going to get. It's a major kind of investment in your life and future. But yeah, it's easy to see how people follow
and how you see how they progress. And with hers, I mean, they all publish, because it's a prospective PhD. Mitra did the four, and that was fine. Sweka did six papers. And went on, and the last one I said, you don't need it, you've got enough for your PhD. But she went, no prof, I want to do it how to integrate quantitative and qualitative. And she's wrote that, and give the midwifery led projects as
excellent.
An example, and it's got the most views because it's new methodology, nobody done it with the matrix. And I were like, so in the end your students teaches you.
Yep.
And I went, oh, I didn't know this, this is good, this is, oh well, yeah, let's, you know, all right, we'll learn together, Sweka. And now she wants us to go over back to Egypt and teach mixed methods, which we might do. But she's in the Samre doing work, and she's done JBI training. And Mitra got a job at University of Adelaide just for now.
Yep.
So I've tried to help them start off, kick start their career. And then I have Monica Diaz and Belinda Lovell finishing theirs, and then Naomi Simpson. And then I was supporting Lois as a co for Kathy Stodley. But Belinda's, I wanted to do work. I was doing health and families, healthy relationships, because of my background with STOP and all the domestic violence or anything. Yep. And I'd always been interested in really vulnerable women. And I wanted to work in the women's prison in Adelaide, and I knew I wouldn't get the funding because they're, you know, they're a forgotten kind of group of women. But I thought, if you get a PhD scholarship, that's the way to do it, isn't it? And we did, and then Belinda, we got it. It's been really one of the most challenging projects we've ever done, because obviously of fear, and they have, and Department of Criminal Services are much more risk averse than the health.
Oh my goodness!
But we got around, and it took us quite a long time to get ethics and to get the approval, and then obviously sort of publicish funding, putting the whole program together, doing the focus groups, and then COVID it, but with the women, and nobody had ever asked them. And there were projects that they were out in the community. Well, they were a special, it needs a bespoke program.
So did you able to look up with Laura and the PIPs in the UK? Laura Abbott.
Laura Abbott, no.
So she's involved with prison populations as well. And maternity services and with that, and I think it's PIPS. So P-I-P-P-S, I can't remember what it stands for now, something to do with prison service. Yeah. But she's kind of, that's her target area as well.
Mothers matter, so it's not just, you know, and actually we couldn't end up interviewing the pregnant women, and there was nine at the time, and we didn't have a mother and baby unit, but they've got one now back in Adelaide, haven't they? And but we did Aboriginal women, migrant women, a separate focus groups to the main focus group, because 32% are Aboriginal women, 29% are migrant women, and the rest are obviously maybe learning difficulties or socially deprived.
And unfortunately, Adelaide has got one of the few mothers and babies units where the babies do not actually return with them from birth.
Yeah.
They get taken away straight away, which is another complete issue that's being worked on.
Yeah, well, they are working on it. Joe Peaks is because they didn't even have a mother and baby unit, where they have now in the health centre, working with SA Prison Health Service. We got level two to go in. And you see, because I'd done a little bit of work in the prison in Huddersfield, just helping with the STOP when I was working, because obviously very vulnerable families. So that has been a real journey, and we've just had accepted the Aboriginal paper. We did a separate one for the Aboriginal women's needs, and that's took a long time to get published, because obviously you've got to, you know, it's quite controversial, isn't it? But we've got there, she went part-time, she's got there, so that was been a really good project. Monica Diaz from the Perineal Trauma, because I got quite a bit of money and I put an online program for Perineal Trauma.
Oh, good.
I got category four, I ended up getting $98,000 for that project. And you think, well, where it is, so you can do midwifery-led research. It doesn't have to be obstetric-led.
And that kind of really goes back to what Mary said to you in the beginning of your career of being a research practitioner.
Yep.
It is slowly, we don't have enough opportunities now, but we're starting to open up that pathway.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be a researcher and you don't have to be an educator. You can actually still be a research practitioner.
And the NIHR in the UK are trying to do that.
Yeah.
They're trying to create that. Mm. I mean, it's slow progress, but it's a start.
We have to start somewhere.
Yeah. And Monica's doing all the work with the FGM in Australia.
Yep.
So that's, and that led from perineal trauma.
Yep.
And then the continents, Julie Tucker.
Yep. The after
effects. She came to me because she was actually at University of Adelaide, but I'd nobody, because all the supervisors had gone. And I thought, well, she's a midwife, I'm going to help her.
Yeah.
I don't see boundaries of University of Adelaide.
Oh, God, no.
If a midwife comes to me and wants help, so I became a supervisor.
Exactly.
And they'll say, well, what's your outcome? Well, it's more publications.
Mm.
You know,
and helping women.
Yeah.
Helping women.
Women with them. And then we did the bladder scanner. We got the Commonwealth Industry Grants.
Mm.
And we tested the bladder scanner as well. And that was really good. We got two bites at the cherry. We got two industry Commonwealth, and worked with Cygnostics.
Mm-hmm.
So we work with us industry partners to do the bladder scanner, because we knew a lot of research and how it worked in general nursing, but not in midwifery and not in maternity. And funny enough, it was okay postnatally, but antenatally,
Completely different.
Completely
different.
They were getting the Liquid, the baby's head
mixed
up. There was a technique of how to scan. And they had to change the algorithms. We had to go back and say, look, it'll work.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we piloted it, and it's like, and then when they did do that, it did work, and we did inter-rater reliability. Yep. And then we got the inter-rater reliability. Because they did the scan within a couple of minutes of each other. So the volumes were it's very similar. So you think all that work, so we're quite good at bringing sort of technology in and STEM as well as the care of vulnerable women. So it's a wide range. I've just got funding now. I've gone a physiotherapist up at Northumbria University as soon as I come back. And they're working with astronauts, and she's a physiotherapist, but astronauts. And they've got this machine called Fred. So I'm intrigued. Fred. I think in Freddy Krueger, what's for
Fred?
And she's, no, it stands for functional readaptive exercise device. So, okay, Fred. Anyway, they use it, it's like a cross trainer, and they use it for core stability and bad backs. Anyway, when she had her baby herself, she had trouble with stress incontinence, which a high proportion of women do. So her, and then her other colleagues who were physio had similar problem. Anyway, just experimented, they started using it just on the off, again, another thing on off chats.
Off the off chats.
And it worked, and I said, well, of course, if it works for backs and core stability, it's going to work for the pelvic floor.
Absolutely.
So of course Mary's ears are like, oh. and it's always like bladders or perineums or, you know, all right, Mary's interested. Anyway, we looked, and then she says, do you think it would work with postnatal women? I says, I think it would, but we'll have to do a feasibility study. So anyway, we've wrote a protocol like there. She's gone to one of the physiotherapy awarding boards, and we've just got 30,000 sterling to do a feasibility study. So I can see
fabulous.
That going then for an NIH at a big grant if we show the evidence. But it's nice how it goes from another area, and it with astronauts, it's coming to...
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You
no,
think,
oh, no.
Maybe that could work for us in our area.
And you just need someone who's got that lateral mind.
Yeah.
Or someone who tries something and kind of go, oh, and then kind of talks to somebody else and you go, oh, that would work really well.
And we did it. And she's just doing a review and she's horrified. She's Mary. She's going to prog and poke and whatever, how you like ask women and find out about stress incontinence. She says, do you know what they do to women, Mary? So I said, oh, go and tell me. I think I know, but go on. She says, well, they put them like in the lithotomy position and ask them to cough and watch them. Would they do that to a man, Mary?
Mm-hmm.
And I went, yeah, no, they wouldn't. No. She said, no, we've got scams. We've got other ways of doing it. Ways, and nobody mentions dignity.
Nope.
And I went, actually, you've got a point there, Kirsty. So I says, right, you got it. All the ways, and that you're going to do it. So she's looking at the literature now. So
excellent.
To see we could do that better in guidelines.
I can always do things better. That's the easy thing. We can always do it better.
Yeah, we can always do better, can't we? So it's always like, there's always loads of projects. My mum said, you're not happy if you haven't got a project. I thought, that's true.
But you look at all of the projects that you've done. It's all about improving the women experience. It's
or
all
care
about
for the women. It's all woman centered.
Yeah.
Care whether they're a vulnerable woman or whether they've got a physical injury from the, you know, the perineal trauma to relieve, and it's the relief pain or anxiety or some sort of discomfort, stress incontinence. And there's a lot of taboo subjects there. But to the woman, you know,
well, it's her life.
Shame, and it's all the quality of care.
Shame is that big word, and I think that was something that I was listening to somebody mention, that Brené Brown did a big research on shame kind of like a decade ago, and found out that was the feeling of shame was the biggest indicator of women not engaging.
Yeah.
And especially when you think about any to do with the issues that we don't talk about, as you said, the taboo issues that we don't talk about. We don't talk about sex. We don't talk about if kind of after women, so many people have stress incontinence. They will have incontinence and yet they won't talk. They would rather actually just wear pads and actually go and admit to someone and talk to someone about it, because we don't talk about it.
And how's that linked to mental health?
Exactly.
And I remember our shadow minister, Norman Lamb, I really liked him. And he said the parity of esteem, that mental health should have equal weighting to physical health, and it doesn't. And they've said here he's still doing a lot around mental health, Mary. I said, well, yeah, because you can't separate. Why do we try and deal with physical health over here and mental health over there? They're entwined.
Exactly.
You can't, if one causes the other or vice versa. Do you know what I mean? And that's why I'm doing a lot of work. And when I was in Australia, I'm always thrive on learning. So I did the Australian Psychology Society there in direct counselling. And I'd done counselling back in the UK. I'd got a certificate. And then I did the clinical hypnosis.
Yep.
You know, with the clinical hypnosis, South Australian Society, because it's tools. And it goes on. And then I went and I thought, finally, before there, I went up to the Namten Institute and did their postgraduate diploma in mental health. Because they said to me, would you want a master's? And I said, well, no, I didn't. Because what I did was they were going to introduce the higher level practitioner in the UK, and then they didn't when the UKCC came in, and they asked me to do a whole programme, put a big portfolio together and go through what we call the City and Guilds to demonstrate that you're such a high level and are a community practitioner that you were awarded, and we were all awarded a Master's in City and Guilds Institute because we demonstrate the evidence. And the police do that in the fire service because you're at that level, but how do they your impact and your level of knowledge, how do you translate that into sort of a recognized pathway and a qualification? And it was the City and Guilds Institute that they have done with there, and we were doing that and I think there were 17 midwives that were put forward, and we have to demonstrate the evidence that you've met all those, and it was a lot of work.
So would that be
a big e-portfolio?
So would that be equivalent to the endorsed that we have in Australia, or would that be kind of, that's more to do with just qualification and recognition as opposed to scope of practice?
Yeah, this work you had to demonstrate your skills, your competencies, if you like, in different areas. So you had to meet a lot of different criteria, which
are broader than what
the
endorsed.
And a lot of it came from even in house, all the NHS. Yeah. CPD and everything, that then you got the it's a master's qualification through the City and Guilds Institute, and the UKCC were doing that, but then they decided not to. pathway. So when they've done all the pilot and all this work, but they're only a small cohort, then they just, you know,
it doesn't cost effective.
And then it all changed regulation, and then it became the NMC.
And they had their own rulings as well. So if you've got somebody, and one of the questions that I kind of, well, one of the comments I hear quite often is when I kind of talk, because I'll talk about PhDs and postgraduate studies to anyone at any time, because I think they're so important to enhance what we're doing and improve what we're doing. But if you've got someone who comes up to you and says, look, I'm not smart enough to do a PhD, how do you respond to them?
I'd say it's not the most educated student that I want to supervise. I want the most motivated. Because you will, a lot of it's grit, true grit, it's perseverance.
Yep.
And what do you mean? Define to me you're not smart enough. Do you know me? I believe you can. Look at all the international students, the English in their first language.
Yeah.
They've all succeeded and got there. And then I say, look where you were and now look where you are.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and it's come. And sometimes it is, when you're doing your PhD, it's hard. But we always do the three kicks, don't we? Mm. Like you do in education, you kiss, you kick, you kiss. That's great.
It's definitely an up
that's
and down.
Them, but really need to work on that. Mm. However, if you do that, you'll come out and get that, and that'll be brilliant.
And in those down times,
it's the sandwich effect, isn't it?
It is. But and those kick times is when the supervisors, that's what their role is.
Yeah.
But also celebrating each little milestone and actually kind of not waiting to the end and kind of going, I've got this far or I've done this.
And I think the PhD by publications is a fantastic way to do it, because when they get their first publication, it might be the literature review or the research protocol, because, you know, we're publishing the protocols as well. It's amazing because they do it.
It's like, they're out there.
Wow factor, isn't it?
Yeah, it's getting harder. Like the publications, when you look at
the
whole...
And I don't like them with the payment.
Exactly. It's getting... My concern is that it's going to break eventually. The system has to break because it can't keep going the way it's going. But how much is that going to influence people trying to do it by publication in the future? I think the next 10 years are going to be the breaker point for the system.
It's always hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know I said at the workshop here, and when I first wrote, and I wanted to help other midwives because they said they didn't understand, because it's like a new language, isn't it, research language. And I'll give you a laugh. When I went to learning when I was at St. James's, it was evidence-based medicine. It wasn't evidence-based practice then.
Yep.
Remember with David Sackett? And I'd get myself there as a midwife, because I wanted to learn. And I could, you know, go to these in-house sessions, because we had the R&D info at St. James's in Leeds. And obviously it was very medical, and I'm probably the only midwife there. And then medical director who was doing the research kept saying, EBM. And he was got EBM. Well, that would send me off on a different track, wouldn't it? I'm a midwife. So he says, Mary, you're looking very confused. You know, and he means evidence-based medicine. But every time he says EBM to me, I was thinking...
midwifery.
I'm thinking a baby, a breastfeeding problem.
Yeah, yeah.
I've gone down on a different tangent. I said to him, well, every time you say EBM, it means express breast milk to me. And I'm thinking, this woman's got problems with it. And he went, oh, my God. midwives again. That's, you know, an acronym to you might mean something different to me, so you have to explain what.
Yes.
And obviously when you write, always to put the acronym first.
Yes.
And you get those skills for writing and the craft, and when we're writing and we do, and all my former PhD students are doing like projects with me, or we can pull in on help each other, and they all go, yeah, but will you write the discussion, Mary? You know, they say, well, sometimes I can pinch someone from the background, you know, because it's like, yeah, it's a craft.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
And then you should, and always have your strengths and limitations. Never just the limitations. What's the strengths?
Yes.
Then what's the
and you've got, there is a formula that is, yeah, you kind of sit there, dot point it all, and then you kind of craft it out. So it
you
kind
know,
of works.
And it's that belief, you know. Yeah. And if it don't work, all right, we didn't get that. Right, try another door then. Another, yeah, door's going to open.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
And it's like, oh, and the mouth used to get distraught when they got, you know, rejected for it. I says, oh, it's part of course. Let's see another one. And then corrections, right, let's, yep, start with the table.
Yeah.
Let's do the review, yep, response. We agree with some, but not others. If it's out of scope of the paper,
yep,
you just have to say that.
Yeah.
But some of it is really helpful.
Absolutely.
So don't take it personally.
It's all learning.
It's all learning. And actually, I didn't think of it from that perspective.
Yeah.
So that's actually improved your paper. But yes, it's a game, because sometimes some of them can feel threatened because it's their area of expertise.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you have to learn how
and they
to
haven't
do
been
it.
Included, or they haven't been cited, and then, yeah, some are just pedantic and some are just mean, and,
yeah,
some of them have a very bad day and shouldn't be reviewing anyway. Thank you very much. Kind of like for kind of sitting in a hotel or a convention centre kind of dining room table. Hopefully the sound's kind of come out really cool. But I really appreciate your time and kind of being able to grab it while
you.
We're here.
And there is a thing I have to do that I have avoided, was the Handbook of Midwifery Research, because I wrote that book in nice simple terms so midwives would understand what research is. But I've got to do with the second edition. Anyway, I've asked if I can bring other midwives on to help me, because I just don't have the time. And I just think, I've got to have a life. I can't be doing this every other weekend. So
sustainability.
Yeah, so yeah, if you want to be involved.
Oh, hell yeah, absolutely.
I need other midwives to help me write the chapters, and I'm putting in a new chapter on mixed methods. But obviously I've got to update. But I showed that we could do any type of research, whether,
yep,
it's action research, phenomenology, whether it's a, you know, randomised controlled trial, that we were capable.
Oh, so here you go. This will probably go out in the next couple of weeks after the ICM, because I'm going to upload it when it's at home, because the internet's a little bit better. So if you're interested, you'll actually be able to tag into Mary's details. So drop her a line and start the conversation, because you never know where it could take you by having this door open.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.